My name is Germ. This is Germ Warfare, the Battle of Ideas. It's 9 o'clock here in South Africa, so that means I have my Jack Daniels with me. And my guest, who I'm about to introduce, is in the United States, which means that it's still too early for him to have a Jack Daniels. Quote, "When I left academia, my real education began." Michael Rechtenwald, former New York University professor of liberal studies and author of multiple books with multiple qualifications behind your name. It's a great pleasure. It's a great pleasure to have you here.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
What does that even mean, liberal studies?
Well, it doesn't mean liberalism as such, that's for sure. It means more or less, it was kind of like a small liberal arts college within the university. So it taught all kinds of topics, you know, it's all kinds of subjects, really. We had, there were historians and political scientists and literature people, basically a kind of liberal arts school.
But what does that term liberal mean?
In this sense, it's supposed to mean a broad exposure to education, like including basically a broad swath of all kinds of topics and subject areas, with a kind of open inquiry and critical reasoning dimension to it. In other words, you know, critical thought with reference to history, science, literature, you know, all the humanities, social sciences, political science. So you're supposed to cultivate this kind of quote unquote liberal attitude towards things. And here, liberal means kind of like latitudinarian. That is kind of broad and ecumenical. Not what it is, actually. It's really an indoctrination camp at this juncture. It's not about liberal in this broad sense. It's very illiberal, really.
Weirdly, you actually have to purposefully be anti-PC these days to be normal.
Yeah, I would think so, yeah. Because what's coming down, what is politically correct is actually psychologically, socially, and logistically insane. So, you know, what counts as political correctness is all kinds of crazy beliefs that are just absurd. For example, I mean, transgender ideology, you have to subscribe to critical race theory, you have to believe in you know, basically you have to be a socialist at this point. You have to be a Marxist in some sense. At least your ethos has to be Marxist. You have to believe in oppressors and oppressed, and you have to believe in these. Yeah, that this whole, the whole society is based on oppression, that capitalism is oppressive and white supremacist. These are sort of the tacit beliefs that you have in order to be politically correct. Yeah, it came out of critical legal studies, and it borrows from critical theory, which is the Frankfurt School, and postmodern theory, which are the French theorists from the 60s and 70s. It cobbles together all these different oppositional frameworks, if you will. Opposition is the key term here. Everything has to be opposed to the hierarchies, to the established ways of everything. And all of these things are deemed oppressive. And so all the outcomes in society are based on some sort of oppression and power differentials and so on and so forth. So no matter what you're looking at, any kind of outcome must be based on racist or sexist or class-based power differentials.
What is your history, Michael? I mean, how did you end up where you are now, mentally?
Oh, that's a great question.
I didn't mean the word mentally in a derogatory way.
Yeah, how did I end up like this? I hope I haven't ended up yet at all. But how'd you end up like this? What happened to you? I was a Marxist, you know. Trained in this school of thought, like through my academic career. I got a PhD in literary and cultural theory, and then it changed to literary and cultural studies while I was in this department. And, you know, we studied all things like Marxisms, feminisms, postmodern theory. We studied socialisms of all kinds, and we studied just the whole panoply of doctrines. And sooner or later, I kind of got roped into it. I mean, I started to believe it because, you know, when this comes at you nonstop and you're not reading anything else, you know, you start to subscribe. And so I basically became a Marxist with a kind of postmodern inflection, if you will. And, I was in an English department, but really didn't study literature much. And I ended up writing a dissertation in the history of science, but that had really nothing to do with my politics too much, except that I studied working class science and things like that, and ended up becoming a scholar of secularism, strangely enough, and became like a world-leading scholar in secularism. Critical theory and all this science studies, all these different approaches and methods I was involved in. But my avocation was as a Marxist. And it all flipped. The whole script flipped because I came out against like a lot of the craziness going on campuses. Even when I was a Marxist, I didn't believe in indoctrinating students. And I didn't think the university should be partial. I thought it should be impartial with respect to politics and ideology. And I started seeing that this social justice had infected everything. And even the policies were now social justice policies. So one day I realized that if I started expressing what was actually going on in my mind, what I was thinking, that it would be quite a revelation. And so I decided to do it. And, here we have this NYU professor, deeply steeped in the left, deeply abiding by the left, and then suddenly has these very critical thoughts with reference to it all. And I started expressing them in this Twitter, on Twitter. And then I got interviewed by the student newspaper. And within 2 days, I was forced into a leave of absence and condemned.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah. Within 2 days, I was an apostate. I was a heretic. They roundly condemned me, and I was accused of wrong think straight up. They said I was guilty for the structure of my thinking. So yeah, then they shipped me off. Listen to this. I sued some colleagues because they kept libeling me in these emails to the whole department. So I sued them, and they ended up moving me to the Russian department. They moved my office to the, yeah. And like I had my own personal gulag, in effect. They basically made me like a prison, like in a prison camp on campus, because they wouldn't allow me to be with anybody else. They people wouldn't even get in an elevator with me. They acted like I had some sort of ideological leprosy. And, I was called everything in the book, white supremacist, alt-right, sexist, racist, short pants, white devil, Satan,
short
as
pants.
Well. Yeah, short pants, white devil. I don't know what the hell that means still. Satan himself. So I got all of them, became the lead.
Simply for having ideas.
Yes. Yeah, for ideas that they didn't approve of. Oh, they were criticisms of the leftism that was rampant. You know, I just saw how crazy the left had become.
Michael, let's just quickly break that down. What is leftism?
That's a great question. I mean, there's so many ways to answer it. Leftism is generally a kind of it is a very serious dissatisfaction with the way things are, and it is placing all that dissatisfaction on the structure, on the system. So every dissatisfaction is blamed on the hegemonic structure of society, or the dominant powers that be. And leftism is a serious dissatisfaction with the status quo, based on the idea that every problem you have and every failure that you encounter is really not your own, that it's some structurally determined outcome. It's structurally determined, you know, whether that be class, race, gender, you name it. It's all structurally determined.
Would you say that it's somewhat utopian in its ideals?
Yes. Yes, I would say that utopianism is the opium of the left. And just... Yeah, utopianism is the opiate of the left. It is what basically has them in its thrall.
Right.
There's this idea that you can establish like this near perfect society on Earth, and that everything short of that must be destroyed.
Okay, but I mean, Michael, I mean, it sounds great. I mean, why wouldn't you want to move towards a utopian kind of existence?
Well, what I figured out is that every utopian is a totalitarian in waiting. That what you have to do to establish utopia is to basically crush other people. You must silence, you must destroy other ways of thought. You have to destroy other perspectives. You must crush dissent in order to create the society in which everybody abides by your beliefs. You must be a totalitarian.
It sounds almost as if Lenin might have agreed with you.
Yes, he agreed with me. He did agree with that. That's exactly what, and he set out to do it. He said that we can abide no criticisms of the Bolshevik ideology. Nothing can stand in its way. Everybody that disagrees must be silenced, either by death or gulag or what have you.
Yeah. And would you separate the term left and liberal?
Oh, yeah.
How?
Well, in the U.S., there's this conflation of the two, but it's mistaken, because the left is illiberal. They don't allow liberality of thought or independence of thinking. Whereas I'm a classical liberal, and that is, I believe in free speech, individuality, liberty, and the rights of the individual. And they don't believe in any of that. They think individualism is either bourgeois, which means it's siding with capitalism, or else it's white supremacist, or else it's just delusionary, because you don't really have an individual selfhood that isn't constructed for you by the social order. That is, yeah. So it's completely fabricated idea. It's purely ideological in their mind. whereas I see the left as purely living in ideology.
And one of the aspects of, you know, Michael Rechtenwald is very much anti-totalitarian, very much free speech. Do you think that we are kind of heading back towards the 1700s, in a sense? If you look at the way in which censorship it seems to have escalated, for example, in particularly with regards to big tech.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've gone back into the Inquisition, only now it's a political Inquisition. It's based not on religious creed or heresy, but on political and ideological heresy. So it's an inquisitional mentality. Mm. And there is this idea of stamping out all dissent and all difference of opinion, all thoughts that don't accord with this creed, with this doctrine, with this ideological domination of leftism, really. If you're a leftist, you can say anything you want. You can say that on Twitter, you can say that I want to kill you, I'll blow your head off, I'll take you out back and shoot you in the back of the head. You can say any kind of homicidal thing that you want. If you're not a leftist, you're deemed, you know, dangerous, and you'll be condemned and blocked and deplatformed and so on and so forth. You'll be disappeared.
Canceled.
So we're undergoing a socialist, Marxist, postmodernist, leftist revolution at this time.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting, and I know you've commented on this in the past, but you're talking about being cancelled, and I'm reminded of that incident at Berkeley, I think it was, with Milo Yiannopoulos.
Right. Milo was, they burned the campus down just to keep from speaking.
That was it. He was just there to speak.
Yeah, I mean, they did the same. They didn't quite burn the campus down at NYU, but in the fall of 2016, he was supposed to speak, but they canceled the event because they said it was too close to the LGBTQ center. And if somebody walked by the door, they might overhear it and they might be injured or damaged, or they might suffer they might suffer from what he had to say. So they canceled that event. And that was one of the things that tipped me off of what was going on. So I invited Milo to speak in my classroom later.
And what happened?
They shut it down. The mayor of New York City shut down my classroom. It was a class meeting of 15 students, and Bill de Blasio stepped in and shut it down and canceled my class. They said it was too dangerous to have him come on to campus. And too dangerous, because whatever he might say would be a danger to the community. They shut it down. I was having him come on Halloween to speak about Halloween and the cultural meaning of Halloween, things like that. Basically, we were going to talk about, like, how, you know, It's verboten to wear a Halloween costume for one night, but, you know, if you can change your identity on the fly, if you're on the left, you can become a woman and there's no problem. But you can't wear a costume for one night. That's not okay. Things like that. And how insane this sort of hypocrisy, but also lunacy.
It's so strange. I don't understand what's going on. What do you think is going on? How is this infiltrating? What is it? Is it a virus of the mind? I'm trying to work this out. What is going on?
Yeah, there's a ideological virus that's spreading, and that's already spread pretty much worldwide, and that is subverting the consciousness of millions and millions of people and turning them into subversive lunatics, such that they think that everything must be overthrown, that everything is injustice, and so they firmly believe this, and and that it's infiltrated every institution in the Western world, from the legal system to the corporate system, the business community, the intelligence community, the intelligence agencies, the military, of course, academia was the first to go. From academia, it spread and infiltrated, and the political system, of course. It's all been overtaken by this virus, by this socialist, leftist, postmodernist virus, which tells you that everything in the world has been constructed by power and that all the edifices must crumble. And that's what's happening. I mean, we're undergoing a broad cultural and political and social revolution based on a mishmash of leftist ideologies.
Do you think it's emergent or is it by design?
That's a good question. You mean by emergent that it had some spontaneous organic basis to it, or is it actually being perpetrated? Well, I can tell you what I think the function of it is. The function is to make the majority believe themselves undeserving of everything they have or might ever have, including their property, their rights. Anything they've enjoyed has been has come by virtue of privilege, and likewise, it should be either abdicated or eradicated. So I think it works to reset. It works with this great reset idea, which is to basically abolish anything like a middle class, where if independent producers and independent agents of all sorts, and to eradicate their position in the society and to create a kind of two-tiered structure with socialism on the ground, actually existing socialism for the broad majority, and a kind of fascism on top which is run by these oligarchs and these global elite who are going to be in control, and the left playing right into their hands. Yeah. They're actually doing the groundwork for these people.
Yeah, I mean, no, go on.
Well, I mean, look at Antifa. They're kind of like the stormtroopers of this movement.
Black Lives Matter also.
And Black Lives Matter, yeah. They're doing the groundwork, and CRT, critical race theory, that is, and socialism and so forth, is doing the ideological work. And it all comes together to create this kind of two-tiered neo-feudalistic system. So if we're going backwards, yeah, we're going back into feudalism with a technological basis, with techno control system and total surveillance state. All of this is being put together. And I think, I don't know whether there was any organic basis to any of these things. They have been appropriated at the very least by this oligarchical group that's using them in order to undertake this. Yeah.
So perhaps it's a combination of both. I mean, I personally think that what we are seeing right now happening around the world with this inverted commas pandemic is very much by design.
The response and the response to it, at least, has been to create this reset. We're supposed to believe that there's always a catastrophe. There's this impending climate doom.
Yes.
And therefore, we are not to have our consumption and our life standards, our mobility and our rights must be taken away in order to address this so-called crisis, which I think is a hoax.
Yes.
Frankly.
No, I agree. And I think that's this is the ultimate plan. It's climate.
Climate is the ultimate pretext, yeah.
Yes.
COVID was just a warm-up. and a warm-up pretext. And I think they'll bring other viruses and things on the scene and vaccines. So this wokeness and COVID totalitarianism, I call it, woke and COVID totalitarianism, is bent on resetting our whole way of life and reducing us to kind of a serfdom, a kind of socialism on the ground, actually existing socialism on the ground with this oligarchical control, yeah, controllers on top, getting rid of old businesses, small businesses of all sorts, independent producers, and funneling all commercial activity to the top, to the Amazons and the Facebooks and the Googles of the world, and leaving everybody else sort of like in a state of subservience and dependence, and without any means to counteract it.
I saw a talk by you, I forget how long ago it was, but it was basically about the sort of Google monopoly.
Google election, I think it was called.
Yes, on censorship, etc. And here's a weird conundrum. Google's a private company. Facebook's a private company, but they almost have more power now than governments, countries, in fact.
Yeah, I think I call them a governmental apparatus. They're state apparatuses. They're, you know, it's true that Google's technically a private company, but their startup funding came from InQtel, which was the funding agency created by the CIA. And so, you know, they got their startup through the CIA's InQtel. Facebook similarly got money through the same circuits, through the intelligence and military intelligence communities. They pass off money to some people, and then those people lend the money to Facebook. So they make it, they kind of obfuscate the direct channels to show, to keep it from looking like they got basically set up by the state, which they did. But it was indirect in the case of Facebook. And now in the United States, you know, they've appointed, Biden has appointed this Mallorca, who's going to be cooperating with Facebook, She's going to be dictating the terms of what is going to be counting as misinformation.
Yeah.
So they're going to completely control, they already are, but they want an even tighter control of information flow and control of people and what they can and cannot say on Facebook, so, and on Twitter. So these outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Google, they have enormous power. They have the power over the whole public square.
Is it inappropriate if I send you my sympathies for your current president?
No, not at all. I think it's appropriate. I think that the country here is being run by a Politburo. You know, this guy is merely just a, I don't even want to say figurehead, he's kind of a skin suit that they have erected. It's the cynicism underneath of it is stunning, that they are that confident that they could put a complete bumbling imbecile and prop him up as the leader of the country and the free world when he can't articulate like a thought. He can't string together a complete sentence, and he has no idea what he's saying, I don't think. And I don't think he can follow a question out to the point where he can make an answer to it, because he's not sure what was asked. By the time he starts talking, he forgot what was even the question. So he just starts saying things like, well, you know how that is, where that happened, and so forth, you know, and there's no substance to anything he says. It's just pure, you know, word salad of without very many words. This is being passed off as legitimate, you know?
No, I don't think it is.
So I think there's like a Politburo running the show, which is like a communist committee that's really in charge. And he's just there to make it all look, well, I don't know what it's making it look like. It's making it look, he's there just to rubber stamp it. But yeah. Really, I think the fact that his vacuity, his lack of content, it is actually working to their favor, because they're basically telling him, don't say anything.
Yeah.
You know, don't say anything. You don't have to say a word. Just mumble shit out. It doesn't matter what it is, and we'll do the rest, you know.
Goes back to something you were saying earlier. She says in the United States, she's in Colorado, in the United States, right and left, conservative and liberal, are understood very differently than in the rest of the world. Would you agree with that?
Well, yes, especially with the term liberal. Here, liberal does not mean what it does in Europe or probably in Africa or in South America even, and certainly not in like Australia, New Zealand, where liberal meant what it meant, you know, in Great Britain, where it was started, which meant classically liberal, which means, it values individual rights and freedom of speech and so on and so forth. Liberal here is illiberal. It means tending towards progressivism and socialism. It's not liberal at all. It's illiberal. Right and left, I don't even think, what I think is going on is that there's basically two groups left. You have those that are basically enforcing the establishment's dictates. They're kind of like agents of the state and the corporate state apparatuses. They're kind of like running around enforcing everything. And then you have dissidents. That's really all you have. And the role of these sentinels of surveillance and power, these little people on the ground that are yelling at you about masks and vaccines, the role of their role is to get you to conform to the dictates of the establishment. And they call themselves leftists. So then everybody else is dissident, and they're all called right wing.
Right.
So any dissidence is called right wing.
It doesn't really mean much anymore, does it?
No, it doesn't mean much. Even so-called conservatives are not really conservative at all. They are not trying to conserve this, that's for sure. They're basically anybody that opposes this new totalitarianism.
So almost reactionary.
Well, against this totalitarianism, yeah. Yes. I mean, how else can they be? Leftist dictatorship, which is being established, they're no longer oppositional.
Yeah.
They actually favor it. So they become conservative in effect. So everything shifts. They want to keep what's coming, which is, or what's here, which is a kind of leftist totalitarianism.
Yeah.
And which identifies with what has been leftist views, but has become dictatorial. You know, I mean, under Lenin and Bolshevism, what would you call people that adhered to Bolshevism? Would you call them?
Yeah.
What would you call them?
Yeah, exactly. Communists.
In fact, everybody that differed on the left, he called them infantile leftism is what he used to refer to them. And then everybody else was a rightist, a right deviationist, as it were. I mean, I guess I'm a right deviationist in the current
context. Not that it really matters, does it?
No. Doesn't, except that's a way. No, it's a way for them to label and discredit you.
Yeah, labels.
Yeah, definitely. Because language is all determining for postmodernism. There's no ontologies. Everything is about language. And so the way language is used is very all determining for postmodern theory. You know, Derrida, father of deconstruction, said that there is nothing outside the text. So everything is words, everything is language. And this follows also if you look at transgenderism, where basically you are what you say you are. It's about language in the end. If I say I'm a man, I'm a man. If I say I'm a woman, I'm a woman. and this shows how language is all determining. Labels are being used to determine what you are, and as such to control what your meaning is.
Yeah, and I mean, it's supremely destructive.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's meant to be destructive. It's meant to destroy opposition in particular. But it also upsets all ontologies. That is, any stable sense of what is and what isn't. It's just totally disorienting, and that's intentional.
Adele in the comments makes a great comment. She says, anybody who isn't a leftist is a deplorable.
That's right. That's true. If you're not leftist, you're deplorable. So I'm also deplorable. And that's fine.
How did she think that she was going to win over half the country by giving them that label?
That moniker. Either she had total hubris to believe that she had such a command that she was going to so clearly win, and it's the biggest political foible in modern history to call the voters who may be on the fence or maybe not in your camp, to call them deplorable, to label the entire other contingent something to demote them and to demean them in such a way was the dumbest political move ever made. I mean, why would you go try? How do you appeal to the other side by basically
insulting?
Insulting them like this. And that's why I called myself the deplorable NYU professor. I wanted to not so much to say that I was an adherent or that I was I really favored Trump. It's the people that she labeled that I was trying to say, listen, I really relate to you, and I wanted to associate myself with them because I felt that kind of dismissal and demeaning language was just such elitism beyond words, you know.
The irony for me, and the absolute epitome of what happened with Trump was when Johnny Rotten, the man who represented punk, like anti-establishment, when he went on to British TV and he said, I'm going to vote for Donald Trump because he lives in the United States now. And he said, because Donald Trump represents anti-establishment. For me, that was brilliant.
Yes, that's brilliant. And that's also emblematic of what was going on and what it is, what it means. And so there is this thing, how does the right become the most anti-establishment group, or what they're calling the right, you know?
Yeah.
So this is what's curious. You have the left, so-called, aligned with big tech, corporate America, the political establishment, the intelligence agencies, and the neocons. I mean, this was a masterstroke on their part.
Yeah, I mean, how did this happen?
They used Trump that way. That's how they used Trump, to get the whole so-called opposition on the side of the establishment. It was a brilliant way they used him to do that, to get the whole left aligning. What, you know, when I say left here now, I mean usually the oppositional contingents in the political order, to get them completely on the side of the powers that be. Brilliant.
His name's Wolfgang, and he has asked this question a number of times, so I think we should read it.
His name's Wolfgang? Wolfgang?
Yeah, Wolfgang,
oh, he must be a Nazi. He must be a Nazi.
He wants to know, why don't governments confront the actual evil people who are making all this money out of misery and terrorism? I'm not entirely certain what he's referencing. Perhaps an earlier comment?
Well, I mean, I think he's calling about the COVID crisis and the way the pharmaceutical companies are cashing in on misery and actually producing death, you know, killing people because they kept palliatives like ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine off the table. They're in on it. That's how this. That's why the governments aren't confronting them. They're in on it. These people are in on it. The political establishment and these corporate monoliths, these corporate beasts, behemoths. They're in on it. They're together. They're on the same page. So the state has no power to. The state has no interest in opposing this. The political operatives are just part of the puzzle here. They're part of the cabal that's doing this. And any of them that try to oppose it, they get crushed.
They're in bed together.
Yeah. The FBI is now suggesting in the United States that they investigate anybody that in Congress who is pro-Trump, that they investigate them for white supremacy and terrorism. Yeah. So, and well, we just found out recently that the FBI probably organized the January 6th insurrection. This was an entrapment plot. They actually entrap these people into what happened.
I mean, what is a conspiracy theorist? It's just somebody who doesn't buy into the established narrative.
That's all it is. It's somebody who doesn't buy into the established narrative. And what is the established narrative? It is a series of lies.
Yeah.
So
another term would be critical thinker.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah,
critical thinker, because everything that's come out of the established narrative has been the opposite of the truth.
Yes,
that's the interesting thing. It's been a complete inversion of the truth.
So why did you leave academia? I mean, you were at NYU for what, about a decade?
Yeah, over a decade. Yeah, and I had been elsewhere for 15 years before that, so I had 25 years in academia. I taught at Duke and other places. It was the environment was so anti-intellectual and so counterproductive in terms of actual thinking and expressing of thought and independent thinking. And it became plus they isolated me and made me like this pariah in academia and on campus. They made it like insufferable, really. I just didn't want to deal with it anymore. So I sued them, and I did get a settlement. So I should say that money was part of it. I got out with a lump sum instead of having to suffer through years getting paid in dribbles, you know.
That's okay. But, I mean, you're not alone. Somebody else who was on my podcast, you might know him, Peter Boghossian.
I know Peter, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, he's also, and he suffered a hell of a lot down there in Portland.
Yeah, I mean, his situation was even worse than mine because, I mean, he was, you know, I mean, he's, I don't know if he, is he still teaching? Did he quit?
I don't think he's teaching at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, his situation was even worse than mine. I mean, he was very vastly underpaid and, his position was very contingent and so on and so forth. You know, I'm not putting this down to him or anything. It's just the way that academics are treated is really badly. So I don't blame him.
And those papers that he had published also didn't help.
It didn't help. That's right. The Sokol Hope Squared. Yeah. That the grievance study stuff. That was great stuff.
It was fantastic. Yeah. I mean, he absolutely, brutally showed the flaws in the system.
The flaws, the absolute hoax and fraud that it is, the complete fraud that it is.
Yeah.
It's completely broken. It's an echo chamber for one. Okay.
I mean, you know about that paper last year, from the Lancet, that massive hydroxychloroquine paper that was completely fraudulent that they retracted. I mean, that was an example.
Yes, in different disciplines, the echo chamber is established under different parameters, but in every case, it's an echo chamber, and all you have to do is echo basically the prevailing beliefs, and if you don't, your chances of getting published are zero. Yeah, that was another thing. The whole humanities, I was in the humanities, even though I did history of science. The humanities are so disgustingly corrupt, and the intellectual caliber is so low. It's garbage what they're producing, like as Boghossian and Pluckrose and Lindzig pointed out. The garbage that they're producing, and it's not scholarship. It's pure rhetorical garbage. It's just ideological mishmash trash. I mean, I don't know what else to call it. It's despicable.
Well, there's a question here in the comments asking, okay, so, I mean, you and I are moaning and ranting and bitching, but how do we fix it?
They're going to ask me for solutions now?
Yes, that always comes.
Yeah, here I come to save the day. I mean, it's been a long march through the institutions that's taken place. It's taken 50 to 60 years to do this. The cultural Marxists, starting with Gramsci and the Frankfurt School, they were at it in the 30s, you know, and this went on for years, decades. It's going to take a huge reformation that will take decades to undertake. I'm just here as a germ for the future, a vestige that might be built on by others. I won't be able to do this myself. So it's going to take people that are willing to hold out and create something that people can build on to reform and reform these systems, to rebuild them from the inside out, or maybe let them rot and collapse and build parallel structures.
Okay, but you're being vague. Come, everybody wants to hear some more practical things that they can do.
Well, what I'm doing is I'm involved in creating an online educational platform that is producing knowledge that's not indoctrination, and that is trying to set the record straight on history, on ideology, on all kinds of areas of thought. So we're trying to, you know, purvey real education, real knowledge, without indoctrinating people. So it's called AmericanScholars.com. So I'm doing something very tangible. The other things you can do in terms of resisting, like this Great Reset, is we need to create networks of resistance to it. Social networks, and I don't mean online necessarily, I mean social networks that can't be broken through digital means, and independent islands of production that we hold out and create independent economic structures. And this includes production and exchange, and alternative currency, probably, as Bitcoin is one. So, you know, Bitcoin is one thing that you can do. And we need to try to fend off a digital, universal digital currency, which is possibly in the pipeline. So we need to have alternative currencies, alternative modes of production and distribution, and alternative social networks that keep us tied together. These deviationists and dissidents have to have networks of resistance and networks that we can build, that we can keep in touch with each other, and that we can exchange things with each other. We can produce things together, and we can stay resistant to cancellation and so forth.
It sounds like you're saying decentralize our lives.
Yes, I think decentralization is key. Decentralization and secession.
Mm. And self-reliance.
Yeah, you don't have to do this even physically. This can be done virtually.
Mm.
Although some people are doing it physically. But yeah, it has to be done. And decentralization of currency, of production and all that, yes, all that has to take place.
And perhaps supporting your farmers directly.
Yes. Trying to find the farmers that aren't, where the land isn't owned by Bill Gates.
but Bill, he's just a nice old man who cares about the world, Michael.
Yes, that's right. He's a philanthropist.
Yes, yes, that's the term. with a little TM at the end.
Yes, he's a philanthropist who happens to probably have eugenic ideas. I'm not sure that he's actually been able to implement any of them, but I think he is a eugenicist. That's just me. I'm only a conspiracy theorist after all.
There's a crystal ball sitting in front of you, Michael. Tell me what do you see?
Well, I've been pretty good at this. My book, Google Archipelago, anticipated a lot of what's happening. Well, as I said, there's probably going to be coming down the pike, you know, a lot of pressure on vaccine resistors, and they're going to peg us as, you know, worse than deplorables, you know, that we're actually mass murderers and things like that. And that, you know, participation in social life will be limited by to those who submit to vaccine protocols. That's one thing that's going to happen. And I think also the reset is going to continue. So they're going to completely have more monopolization, and they're forcing all kind of investments using these ESG scores to the woke / environmentally / governance friendly corporations. This kind of consolidation will continue, but at the same time, the networks of resistance are building and going to survive this. We're not going to lose in the end. We will survive this, and they will not take over, and they will not make a global tyranny a reality. We'll win.
It's an absolute pleasure to have chatted to you. You are a man of great insight, and I've absolutely loved listening to you.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to be here.
If you don't mind, I'm going to go top up my vaccine.
Okay. Okay, great.
My name is Germ. This is Germ Warfare, the Battle of Ideas.